From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm surprisingly telegenic anchorman Bill Curtis, especially at this age. And here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Illinois, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks, everybody. Thank you so much. Thank you. Until recently, Bill Curtis right here worked in the tough world of television news, where the never-ending news cycle means you were on all the time. Middle of the night, no matter. Bill Curtis was on the job.
You know, Peter, I've done some of my best work blitz out of my mind on Ambien.
Well, we do things a little differently in public radio. Allow me to introduce you, Bill, to a new concept. Taking a week off.
It sounds so wrong, yet it feels so right.
So today we're going to play some of our favorite bits from past shows and some of your favorite bits as well. Let's start by going back to the last World Cup in 2010. Carl Castle showed then that his talents were wasted merely reading the news. Carl also introduced our listeners to the world's most hated musical instrument.
Wow.
Oh God, that's annoying.
That was Carl imitating a sound everybody, or at least World Cup soccer fans, now know all too well. What is it?
Oh, it's the South African trumpet.
Well, yes.
I don't know how to say it.
Well, it's okay. We'll give it to you. It's called the Vuvuzela, is what it's called. Very good. That's what it is. And if that doesn't impress you, listen to this amazing special effect. And remember, this was done entirely without computers.
Pew, 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 pew.
That was Carl doing ray gun noises.
Oh, I see.
Right, Carl, repeat after me. Repeat after me.
Pew, 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 pew.
Yeah, don't you know ray gun?
Pew, 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 pew.
It's universal ray gun.
Carl?
Pew, 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 pew.
That's closer.
In March of 2014, we went to Kalamazoo, Michigan, to do our show at Western Michigan University.
It was Kalama Magical.
Along with Carl Castle, Brian Babylon, Amy Dickinson, and Bobcat Goldthwait, we got a chance to interview one of Western Michigan's famous alumni, actor Terry Crews. He lost no time in reminiscing about his college days.
This is awesome, man. Look, I lost my virginity right there in Zimmerman Hall, man.
So you're a Michigan guy. You grew up where? In Flint, right?
Flint, Michigan. All the way, brother. Born and raised.
And you came to Western Michigan, and you were a football player on the team that went all the way to a championship season, right? Back in, what was it, 90, 89, around there?
Yeah, that's it, 1989. But you know, first of all, I walked on in 87 and finally got a scholarship and the whole thing and worked my way on the team. And we were one of the first championship teams that ever hit Western Michigan.
So really, you were not recruited. I mean, this is a football school, but I mean, you just walked on and said, I want to be in the team. And they said, ha, they laughed at you.
Well, I had an art scholarship. I actually had an art scholarship.
Wow.
Wait a minute.
That's how you lose your virginity here.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you, it turns out different people know you for different things. There are like fans who know you for the movie Idiocracy, where you play the President of the United States.
Yes.
There are people who watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and there are a lot of people who know you from these amazing series of very funny Old Spice commercials.
It's so weird because I have fans in different areas. It's so crazy. I go to the mall, it's white chicks.
Yep,
you know what I mean? And I'm like,
oh yeah, the movie
know.
White. It's not you're saying white chicks are your fans. You were in the movie White Chicks.
Yeah. No, the movie. The thing is that, you know, I get fathers coming up to me like, how does my daughter know you? I'm like, man, I'm in a movie, brother. I don't know your kid, okay? the Old Spice thing has become a phenomenon. We literally have changed advertising forever. You may not like it, but you'll never forget it.
Right. I just saw one that just came out in which you play yourself about to shave yourself, and you play one of your own hairs.
Denzel can't do that. Denzel Washington can't even do that.
That's right. You're right. You are actually, you've become, among many other things that we've been discussing, a legitimate action star. You were in the Expendables movies.
Yes.
With Stallone and Schwarzenegger, among many other guys. Did you, like, compare bodybuilding notes with them?
No, you know what? Let me tell you, the highlight of my professional life, period, was have Arnold was on one side of me, and Sly was on the other, and Sly was like, look at his arms. His arms are amazing. And I was like, look at the definition. It's amazing on his arms. It's an incredible definition. And I'm going, oh, my God, this is the truth. These are the reasons why you work out. Both of these guys launched 10 million workouts. You know what I mean?
But before we go to the game, we have a question. We understand that you have a nickname for yourself?
I call myself the amusement park. That's because I'm funny and scary at the same time. That's I like that.
Now, I like that too, but in what context do you use that nickname for yourself?
Well, you know, it's funny because I used to use it in auditions, which was crazy. First of all, when you're black in Hollywood, you know, your first role is going to be on a crime drama. That's, everybody knows that.
Right.
And half of my role, when I started my career, was off intimidation. And then what would happen is I got on the set, and then I would flip it and be funny. So I use both as needed. You know what I'm saying? It's one of those things that I realized that was my way in, but what was going to keep me here was the funny. I still do it on Brooklyn Nine-Nine all the time.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, it's also good. You can use that nickname. You're like, I know you're a happily married man, so maybe on a certain evening you might say, hey, you want to feel like a ride in the amusement park?
She's got the lifetime pass.
Yeah, I understand.
How tall do you have to be to get on?
Well, Terry Crews, we are delighted to talk to you. We've asked you here to play a game we're calling...
They're having all-you-can-eat shrimp cocktail buffet on the Lido deck.
So your name is Crews, but what do you know about cruise ships?
Wow.
The floating behemoths that bring all the comforts of a Short Hills, New Jersey mall to the world's waters.
Yes.
We're going to ask you three questions about cruise ships. Answer two right, you win a prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice, on their voicemail. Carl, who is actor Terry Crews playing for?
Meg McAllister of Waterford, Michigan.
All right, Terry, you ready to play? She's probably right here.
I'm ready.
She's a homegirl. First question, the Crystal cruise ship line out of Japan has a special class of employees. What is their job? A, to stand on fake crow's nests, pretending to scan the Caribbean Sea for icebergs.
Oh, God.
B, to dress up really nice and dance with the lonely old rich ladies. Or C, to randomly check toilets, wastebaskets, and other receptacles for any sign of intestinal illness breaking out.
Wow, that's a tough job.
It is.
I gotta go with C, because there have been so many of those lately. They gotta make sure that, you know, there's no big-time disease about to happen on this ship.
It would make sense, but actually it was B, to dress up nice and dance with the lonely old rich ladies.
Oh,
they're called ambassador hosts. This is a wonderful thing. They're usually retired gentlemen who are excellent dancers. That is the first requirement. And they're supposed to provide elegant companionship, conversation, and dance for the single ladies. Tipping is optional. All right, you still have two more chances. You can still win this. It's not only humans who have to endure cruises. Which of these is a real headline that proved cruises aren't safe for any species? A, ghost ship crewed by cannibal rats, presumably sunk. B, tragic end to shipboard aquarium as passengers mistake it for sushi buffet. Or C, dolphins bruise themselves on cruise ship hull as they try to flip it up in the air.
Oh, wow. Oh, I'm going with A, the ghost ship
and crewed
the
cannibal rats.
Yeah.
That sounds like a winner.
The Western Michigan community agrees with you, and you were all right.
Yeah.
You may remember. This was the abandoned ship. This is this old hulk of a ship that got loose from its tow and was floating toward Great Britain in January. Everybody was freaking out because people were speculating that the rats on board had turned cannibal. This cannibal rat ship was going to hit England.
So are they eating other rats? Or you can't. Cannibals eat each other, right?
A cannibal rat would presumably eat other rats.
They'd eat each other.
Yeah. They'd eaten everything else.
If a rat eating a human is just a lucky rat. You've gotten one right with one to go. Last question.
Okay.
While getting violently ill may seem to be the worst thing that can happen on a cruise ship, not to mention falling overboard, one passenger had to deal with something far worse. What was this passenger's complaint to his cruise line? A, that the cruise's stand-up comedian made jokes about dumb people, and as a dumb person, he was offended. B, that it was too cold and cloudy to get a tan on his cruise to Alaska. Or C, that the ship tilted to the right just as he was finally about to beat his wife at shuffleboard.
Oh, I'm going with B. It's too cold
to get a tan to Alaska.
It's too cold to get a suntan.
They like it, and they're behind you, and you're right. That's what the complaint was.
People can whine. They do that.
The man complained, but all cruises are meant to be hot. That was his logic as to why he...
No, Peter. They're meant to be hot. Yeah.
Carl, how did Terry Crews do on our show?
He had two correct answers, Peter, so he wins from Meg McAllister of Waterford, Michigan.
Terry Crews, star of the Golden Globe Award-winning series Brooklyn Nine-Nine and the movie Single Moms Club out now. Terry Crews, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Bye-bye.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks, everybody. This week, we're going back and taking stock of what we did to get to this point.
Oh, it's like an intervention. I've had lots of those.
Kind of like that, Bill. Listeners tell us they look forward to the Listener Limerick Challenge toward the end of each week's show, but they also tell us they don't look forward to when I preview the game, usually with a terrible pun. Here are some of the best, or perhaps if you like, the worst, Limerick promos. Thank you so much. In just a minute, Carol checks you for ticks to make sure that you don't have rhyme disease. It's our Listener Limerick Challenge. In just a minute, Carl right here will reveal that he's a member of the notorious Gambino organized rhyme family in our listener. In just a minute, Carl travels thousands of light years to bring us this week's limericks thanks to a rift in the space rhyme continuum. If you'd like to play, Carl injects the show with a healthy dose of rhymoflavin. Carl resets his clock to daylight savings rhyme in the listener limerick challenge. In just a minute, Carl sees a plastic surgeon about some rhymoplasty. It's our listener limerick challenge. If you'd like to play, give us a call. Thank you so much. In just a minute, Carl plays his favorite Ryman and Garfunkel album in our listener limerick challenge. Carl rises from the rhymordial soup. Carl changes his mobile phone carrier to Verimzun. It's our listener limerick challenge. Last year, with Paula Poundstone, Maz Jobrani, and Faith Saley, we decided to bring back an old game.
Was it rounders? Marbles? Kick the can? Conkers? Mumbly peg? Huckle buckle beanstalk?
No, actually, Bill. Although they all sound like great fun. Let's let Carl explain.
Guess the newsmaker.
So it's time to welcome to our show one Ricardo Baca. Ricardo, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Now, panelists, Mr. Baca here, Ricardo, has a new job. As far as we know, he is the first person to hold this job anywhere ever. Your job, guess what that job is. You'll each get a chance to ask a yes or no question. The first panelist to guess who it is wins a point. Paula, ask your question.
Hey, Mr. Baca, does it involve computers?
Somewhat.
Maz.
Do you have to go to an office every day?
No.
No, so he's out in the field. Okay. Mm-hmm. Faith?
Ricardo, are you dealing with a formerly illegal substance?
Yes.
Yes, he is dealing with a formerly illegal substance. What could it be? Now it moves on to Paula.
How was that an intuitive guess? There's absolutely nothing that was said that led to such a guess.
Are you are you like an FBI profiler or something?
All right, Mr. Baca, Have you had relations with Faye Saley? All right, so he's out in the field. Are you a pot harvester?
I am not.
I'm gonna throw you guys a hint. Mr. Baca is calling us from his home in Colorado.
Oh, mountains.
Well, the weed thing was a good place to go.
Yeah. No, yeah. Mountains were forbidden a while ago.
Okay. Paul asked if he was a pot harvester.
Oh, a pot reviewer?
No.
Oh, but you are awfully close. What we're going to do is we're going to say Maz got it because although Mr. Baca is not a pot reviewer, they will be working for him because Mr. Baca is the first ever pot editor for the Denver Post.
Wow.
Wow. Congratulations.
As far as you know. So, so the point goes to Maz. Ricardo, so you are going to be in charge of the new section, I think it's online for the Denver Post, that will cover the new legal marijuana market in Colorado.
It is, yeah. We're creating a blog out here covering the culture of cannabis.
The culture of cannabis. How did you get this job? How do you apply to be the pod editor?
Exactly right. Well, I started a music festival for the paper, and then I started a music blog, and both of those things have done fairly well. So I think they thought of me when this position came up.
Yeah. They went down to your music festival. They took a whiff. They're like, this is the guy. We are assuming pot editors must be constantly paranoid they're going to get fired.
Well, I do work for a newspaper.
That's true. Ah. So you're going to be hiring marijuana critics, right?
I am, yeah. I'm in the process of getting some reports back from them. I assign them each a strain or an edible or a soda, and I'm starting to get those back.
What do you mean, or a soda?
Oh, the market is huge. You can get pot-infused olive oil and sodas. It's crazy. They have everything.
I'm assuming that as the pot editor, you're going to have to be, you know, partaking yourself to do your job correctly, right?
You know, I don't necessarily need to, but it's...
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
It's legal.
Are you going to have deadlines?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Many, many deadlines.
Okay.
Yeah, how's that going to work?
Well, Ricardo Baca, we're delighted to talk to you. Good luck in your
Congrats.
New job. Ricardo Baca is the new online pot editor for the Denver Post. Thank you so much for being with us.
Nice.
Now, back in 2010, we were joined by Tony Shalhoub, a brilliant actor, best known for playing the title role on the show Monk, as well as many other crazy and or odd people. In fact, I wondered if that was his specialty.
I think you're right. I don't remember normalcy in my career.
Did you get that? Because I know how Hollywood works. Did you get pegged early? I need somebody kind of wild-eyed and indeterminately ethnic. Get me Shalhoub.
Somebody who worries a lot.
Yes.
Whenever I do get those roles that seem normal, something overtakes me, and I kind of try to turn them into something not so normal. So it's partly my fault.
So the initial character is kind of Mike Brady standard issue.
Exactly. That's what Adrian Monk was, actually, to start with.
Really? And you showed up and started twitching.
I said, I think this guy twitches. And then they build a series around it.
But, I mean, the concept, I'm assuming that when they came to you with the part, they were like, well, this is this guy, and he has all these skills, but he's also kind of obsessive, compulsive, and very weird in all these ways. And, I mean, and did that, you were like, that's what I want to do.
Well, I'm always looking for something that's slightly, off-center. And that particular role was such a pleasure because I got to do, doing comedic things back-to-back with more serious, poignant things. And it's kind of an actor's dream, really.
But by being a success in a TV series, you always run the risk of being identified with that role. So do you have people coming up to you and going, oh, I'll shake your hand. No, I won't, because I know how you feel.
Yeah, I've heard that about 6,000 times.
I can imagine.
Today.
Today.
Yeah.
Does it get tired? Were you worried about that as you continue during the series, that you were being known for this one role?
It's always kind of a risk, an inherent risk when you're an actor, and you even if it's a movie role, sometimes people just get pegged as that one thing. But maybe when I was younger, typecasting might have been a problem. Now, No, it's any kind of casting is good. You know?
Yeah, basically, you take typecasting.
I'll take anything.
You'll be stunt doubling.
I'll take fly casting at this point.
It could have been a lot worse. People could have seen you and gone like, dynamite!
That's right.
Oh, yes.
That's right.
You could have a catchphrase.
Yeah, exactly.
You starred in Big Night, one of my favorite movies. For those who haven't seen it, it's about two brothers from Italy who try to open an Italian restaurant in New Jersey. And it doesn't go well, and it's about the last night of its operation where they serve the most amazing meal ever served on film.
Oh, Peter, I really don't think there's anybody who hasn't seen that.
That's true. Was that meal real? Did you get to eat it?
Well, yes. Well, a lot of the things were real. We did actually make them over, you know, the course of the making of the film. Of course, you know, while you're filming and doing multiple takes, you know, food tends to... it tends to get a little undesirable.
It wouldn't stop me in the case of that meal.
No, but I've gotten a lot of free Italian meals in restaurants from people.
Really?
People who like that. I consider it my back end on the movie.
Really?
Kind of, yeah.
This endless free pasta special.
Exactly.
Which is weird because you are not, in fact, Italian.
I'm not.
Nor.
Oh no. Yes, you're right. No, yeah. I'm actually Lebanese.
You're Lebanese from Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Which is kind of like being Italian. I don't know.
I know. It's like you probably had to stand in for. You played all the ethnic characters in the school plays, I'm sure, in Green Bay.
I actually played the black characters in the plays in Green Bay.
God. Dynamite.
You think I'm kidding?
No, I'm not. I've been to Green Bay. You were totally not kidding.
Yes.
We have one last question for you. When we have a guest on, of course, we sit down to do a lot of research to learn a lot of things about them, and instead we just play video games all day, and then right before the show go to Wikipedia. and your Wikipedia mentions a connection between you and somebody named Dan Shalhoub.
Well, Dan would be my brother.
Dan is your brother.
That's correct.
And according to Wikipedia, Dan Shalhoub, your brother, has a particular claim to fame.
Yes, he does.
Can you tell us what that is?
Well, he is the inventor of the shapoopy.
The shapoopy.
Which is a thing that all dog owners who live in the urban areas should have. It's not just a pooper scooper. It's better than that. Mm-hmm. It actually kind of, well, how can I put this?
I just want to see you navigate this on the radio.
Yes, thank you. It actually is a device that catches the poop before it hits the ground.
Wow.
Whoa.
So this is your brother?
This is my the brother that's closest to me in age.
Right.
Yes,
and what is it like living in his giant shadow? I mean, he's the inventor of the shapoopy.
It's not easy. It's a battle of egos, actually.
I understand.
No, wait. We have to back up here because I have two dogs and I need to know this. I live in an urban area. Now, do you have to position this thing?
Oh, my God.
No, your dog does that. Yes, of course you have to position it.
You have to position it. So...
You know, it wasn't always going to be called the Shapoopy. There were many, many, there were many pitches for names for this
program. Oh, tell us them all.
I don't even want to begin to go there because I know your show is classy.
It is.
These names aren't.
It was.
I'll just start.
It was.
This thing.
It wasn't.
See, the thing is, it has a telescoping handle, you see, so you can extend it. It's very small and compact to carry. So one of them, we're going to call it the long arm of the log.
Yeah.
Okay, that's enough.
I love this whole family.
This never happens to Garrison Keillor. I don't know why. Well, Tony Shalhoub, we were delighted to have you here. But we have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Sure, you solved crimes, but did you ever fly? I think not.
Tony Shalhoub, you played a monk, so we're going to ask you about nuns.
Okay, that makes no sense.
That's how we do. Answer two questions about nuns, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice for their home answering machine. Carl, who is actor Tony Shalhoub playing for?
Tony is playing for Nancy Martin of Venice, California.
Ready to do this?
Does Nancy have a dog?
For her sake and the sake of her family, I hope she's not even listening.
Fancy Nancy's plastic basket. Doesn't really rhyme.
No. First question, Tony. First question. Some nuns in Italy got in trouble with the law last year. What did they do? A, they got pulled over going 112 miles per hour in a Ford Fiesta in a hurry to go see the Pope. B, they made so much noise at a late night caffe klatch, the police were called by neighbors. Or C, they were busted for growing hallucinogenic mushrooms.
Okay, well, I went to a Catholic school, when I was a kid. And knowing the nuns were, I'm going to have to go with C, hallucinogenics.
Wait a minute, knowing nuns as you do, you thought they were growing
hallucinogenics? That's right.
That's the sort of thing the nuns might be doing?
Well, they're very spiritually oriented.
They certainly are. So your choice is hallucinogenic mushrooms. No, actually, it was A, it was speeding.
Oh, wow.
Quoting the nun behind the wheel, the police were shocked to find three nuns of a certain age in the Fiesta, but we were afraid of getting there late to see the Pope. She was fined more than $500 and lost her license.
Oh, my.
It's all right. She could still fly, though. She's a nun.
Oh, my God.
Two more chances. In 2008, an Italian priest was criticized for trying to bring attention to nuns by doing what? A, holding a nun beauty pageant. B, convincing Italian paparazzi to follow around nuns because, quote, they're celebrities in the eyes of God. Or C, creating a Nun of the Month Club.
Oh, my God. No pun intended.
Yeah, literally.
All right, you know what? I'm going to go out on a limb here. I'm going to go for the beauty pageant.
And you're right.
Oh,
well,
wow.
Done. The priest said that the nun beauty pageant was only intended to show their, quote, interior beauty, but the controversy caused it to be canceled anyway. All right, this is great. You have one more to go. If you get this right, you win. The Sisters of the St. Francis of the Holy Eucharist Convent in Independence, Missouri, helped out their community in an unexpected way last year. What did they do? A, they raised money for a community center by selling a Ladies of St. Francis of the Holy Eucharist Convent calendar.
Wow.
B, wearing habits and flip-flops, they chased down a robbery suspect leading to his arrest. Or C, they provided the hit Dunk-a-Nun booth at the Independence County Fair.
I'm going to have to go with the Dunk-a-Nun booth.
Dunk-a-Nun. There sits a nun. You throw a baseball at the target, the nun is dunked.
Yes.
I'm afraid it was they chased down the robber.
No.
Yes.
In flip-flops?
In flip-flops. The nuns looked out their window and saw a man hurrying by with a shotgun and boxing gloves. And they figured he was up to no good. And they chased him down and got a description and sent it to the police, and he was arrested for robbery. Carl, how did Tony Shalhoub do in our quiz?
Well, Tony needed at least two correct answers to win for Nancy Martin, but he had just one.
Oh, I'm sorry, Tony.
The Shapoopy will have to do.
Yeah.
Send her one.
I'm going to send her one.
Send her a Shapoopy. Never speak to me about it again.
Well, I'm very, very sorry that I, couldn't win this invaluable prize for your listeners.
Well, I think no one will ever remember it a moment from now.
Tony Shalhoub. What, Peter?
Exactly. There you go. Tony Shalhoub is an Emmy Award-winning star of TV's Monk, seen in the USA Channel. Tony Shalhoub, what a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks to all of you.
Bye-bye, Tony. Take care.
Chapoopy, chapoopy, chapoopy.
My girl is hard to get.
Chapoopy, chapoopy, chapoopy.
Won't you get bigger yet?
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you. This week, thank you. Guys, this week, we're lost in nostalgia as we just sit and relive our old achievements. For example, some of our more interesting games and interviews.
I once saved an entire village by wrestling a wild rhino with my bare hands on the grassy veldt of Tanzania.
It's not a contest, Bill. Here's one of our Bluff the Listener games from March of 2014. Our panelists are going to tell you three stories of heroes standing up for what they believe in. But as you know, most of them are lying.
Hey, how you doing? I'm Needles from Sound Beach, New York.
You said you're Needles?
I'm Tim Needles.
Oh, yes. Tim Needles. It's your name. It's not a creepy nickname. I was worried for a second.
Are you a tattoo artist?
No, it would be great. I am an artist, but not tattoos yet.
Welcome to the show, Tim. You're going to play our game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. Carl, what is Tim's topic?
Profiles in courage.
Change starts with an individual, one man or woman brave enough to stand up for what they believe in. Think Rosa Parks and the bus boycott. Jared of the Subway Guys fight against his own pants. This week we read a story about someone standing alone to fight the good fight, no matter the odds. Guess this real story, and you will win Carl's voice in your home answering machine or voicemail. You ready to play?
Yes, I am.
All right, let's hear first from Mr. Bobcat Goldthwaite.
Arthur Gruntfest was fired from his job at the Donner Poultry Farm in Asheville, North Carolina, after repeatedly complaining about the treatment of the chickens. After reaching out to authorities and feeling that they turned a deaf ear to his clucking, he valiantly launched his own one-man protest against the slaughterhouse's poor conditions by dressing up in a rooster costume and standing outside the factory's gates every day for 2 weeks. Then things got bad. Unbeknownst to him, the suit was covered with actual Rhode Island red rooster feathers and was infested with chicken lice larvae. Due to his excess sweating, larva clusters from the wet feathers soon embedded in his armpits and nether regions, and Gruntfest suffered a major chicken lice infestation. At first, I thought it was just a heat rash, said Gruntfest from his St. Stephen's Hospital bed, where he is suffering from a bird flu virus common among chickens. I don't know if I feel worse from the illness or the fact that I've been wearing the very thing I was trying to save. But on the plus side, all this media attention has magnified the genocide going on at the plant, but the hospital keeps trying to serve me chicken soup.
A man in a chicken suit pays the ultimate chicken price for his bravery. Your next story of a brave stand comes from Amy Dickinson.
Mahatma Gandhi walked 240 miles to protest the salt tax in India. And Nelson Mandela spent 27 years in prison protesting apartheid. And then there's Kevin Walters, the 21-year-old man who spent over 10 minutes chained to the doors of a highway rest stop this week to protest its demolition. The rest stop is an unimpressive cinder block building, but Walters would like to enshrine it because of something that happened before he was even born. In 1993, his parents pulled into the highway oasis along the Illinois Toll Road after a Phil Collins concert. Something really was in the air that night, oh Lord. One thing led to another, he said, and he was conceived. No word yet on whether any of his siblings will protest the closing of the Parsippany, New Jersey Wawa, where his parents stopped after a Third Eye Blind concert in 1997.
Man chaining himself to a highway rest stop in Illinois because that's where he was conceived. Your last story of someone taking it to the man comes from Brian Babylon.
For most people, eating lunch at work is the best part of the day. But for Candace Northcott in Sanford, Connecticut, it became the fight for her life. One by one, her formerly meat-loving, snack-eating coworkers have gone vegan and becoming self-righteous monsters. I thought it was a joke, said Northcott, but then someone threw away my leftover barbecue in a biohazard trash can. Then she received a memo from her HR director saying that the office had voted to go meat-free. Any meat stored in the fridge will be tossed over fears that meat fumes will infiltrate her coworkers' veggies and hummus plates. Norcott asked a fashion designer friend to create a pantsuit made of smoked meat. Something business casual Lady Gaga would be proud of. The next Monday, she showed up in a beef jerky jacket and smoked ham cummerbund for extra flair. I'll give them fumes. Suddenly, her coworkers started hanging around her cubicle like a pack of drooling, hungry wolves. I knew I'd won them over when my jerky jacket went missing from my office. I found the director of HR and the VP of sales in the handicap stall together eating it like a pack of zombies from The Walking Dead. The meat ban was revoked next week. Flaxseed is now a contraband substance.
Tim, these are your stories of a lonely hero doing what they can. From Bobcat, a guy dressing as a chicken and ending up with a case of chicken lice to protect chicken conditions. From A.B. Dickinson, the story of a man who briefly handcuffed himself to a highway rest stop to prevent its demolition because it was so special to him. And from Brian Babylon, somebody who wore a meat suit to the office to protect the rampant veganism.
Smoked meat.
Smoked meats. Excuse me, Brian. Yes. Which of these is the real story of a courageous stand for what one believes in?
Well, I'm always a fan of the highway rest stop. I'm going to go with number two.
You're going to go. You like highway rest stop.
I enjoy the highway rest stop.
All right. So your choice then is Amy's story. Well, we actually spoke to this lonely hero.
21 years ago, my parents were at a Phil Collins concert. One thing led to another. They ended up at the Oasis, and I was conceived there.
Yeah. That was protester Kevin Walters talking about the night he was conceived at a rest stop outside Chicago, Illinois. Congratulations, Tim. You got it right. You've earned a point for Amy, and you have won our prize. Carol Castle will record the greeting in your voicemail. Well done, Tim.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for playing with us today, and take care. Now, I end every show by saying, this is NPR, and every now and then we are required by contract to act like we really are NPR.
So in 2013, we invited a very classy guest to talk with Peter, Paula, Faith, and Tom.
Billy Collins is the most acclaimed poet in America today. He was the country's poet laureate from 2001 to 2003. Now, we could try to describe what his poetry is like aesthetically, but this is 21st century America. So let's just say that poetry is just like song lyrics, except they don't rhyme and you talk them. Billy Collins, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
It's great to be here. Thank you. That's not a bad description.
I think so. The first thing I have to ask is, did you find that a folksy, friendly name like Billy Collins was an obstacle to you in your poetry career?
No, well, I actually adopted that name because there is a romantic poet, English romantic poet, whose name is William Collins.
Really?
So, actually, I'll just tell you, your audience can't listen to this on the radio, but when I was in college, I thought you needed to have a very literary name, so I called myself W. James Collins.
See, that's what I would expect.
Yeah, but then I downshifted to Billy because there is a William, and also I just got more relaxed with my poetry, so I didn't... William sounds like the name of a king.
Right.
To me.
That's the same reason I went with Tom Baudet.
Do you ever adopt the classic poetic lifestyle? Do you wear a beret?
I can't tell you what I'm wearing right now because we're on the phone.
Yeah.
But, no, I try to be inconspicuous. I really don't have a distaste for poets who announce themselves at 50 yards.
Right.
You know, here he comes, you know, with the beret and the cane and the cape and the whatever Michigas is part of the outfit there. But you can spot him from a mile away. It's just like a billboard. I'm a poet. I'm flashing. I try to fit in.
Yeah.
I try to make the poems eccentric. I don't want to look eccentric.
Now, here's the thing. I actually made a little joke about this, but it's true, which is that poetry per se has fallen out of favor. Nobody wants to read poetry. Everybody's bored by poetry. But everybody loves music, popular music, which almost always has lyrics, which are almost always a form of poetry, right?
Well, music is public, though. I mean, you put it on, many people can listen to it at the same time.
Right.
Whereas poetry is usually the intake of poetry is solitary and private. It's you sitting in a room with a book open. But, you know, the real test is to read lyrics without music. You know, if you got everybody off the stage, like all the musicians, and the three girls in the back in the satin dresses, they have to get off the stage, too. And you just have to get up there with a piece of paper and then read your lyrics. They're not going to hold up.
Well, dude, I think you're going the wrong way. You don't want to take that away from them. You want to get that for yourself.
Yeah, you need the...
You need some backup singers, a guitar.
Okay, I need the girls in the sequin dresses.
Exactly.
Okay. Now
I know it's missing in my act.
Exactly. That's my point.
Billy, this Tom, I've seen your act. In fact, I own four books of poetry. Walt Whitman is one, and the other three are yours.
Oh, nice.
And so I'm a bit of a fanboy here, but I just want to say that what you do with poetry is rarely done. Is you almost all of your poems have a punchline of some kind, and I got to believe that that is makes poetry so much more approachable for people.
Thank you. I'm smiling now.
Yeah,
you can't see me, but I'm smiling.
Well, your poems they tend to be things you've done or seen.
They're accessible. Yeah, they usually start out very straightforwardly. And plainly, I think it's good not to make demands on the reader too early. But as the poem goes on, I want the journey of the poem to lead into some interesting places. I sort of like the idea of Dorothy, you know, that the poem begins in Kansas and maybe ends in Oz.
Right.
But I want a lot of poems start in Oz, and I think that puts people off.
Yeah.
They don't want the flying monkeys in the first line.
When did you first decide that you wanted to be a poet?
It wasn't a single decision. It was just really following a compulsion to write poems, which started as a child, really. But we all write poems as a child.
Oh, yeah.
We love, you know, as children love the ingredients of poetry. And then they go into this tunnel that we call adolescence. And when they come out of it, they hate poetry.
Well, when I was an adolescent, and I'm sure this is true of, let's see, this is NPR, 98% of our audience, I wrote very very sad, melancholy, self-indulgent poetry.
I did too.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask, was your, since you are now a successful and award-winning poet, do you feel that your self-indulgent adolescent poetry was better than average?
Well, we're all born with 200 bad poems in us.
Really?
this is statistically proven. And middle school and high school is a good time to get rid of those. But I wrote this, I believe, because this is what I was reading, I believe that poetry was two things. It was hard to understand, but one thing you could understand is that the poet was miserable.
Yes.
So I pretended to be miserable, and it's very easy to write poems that are hard to understand. Finally, I read poets who were not so miserable, in fact, humorous, and they gave me permission to release what I was repressing, which was this sense of humor I inherited from my father.
Right.
Have you ever recited your poetry to get lucky with somebody?
I've recited to like hundreds of people at a time, but
how'd that work?
It didn't work. Yeah, it didn't work out.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not whispering it in somebody's ear, no.
Well, Billy Collins, it is a pleasure to talk to you. We've asked you here today to play a game we're calling
I Can Feel It Coming in the Air Tonight.
So you're Billy Collins, poet. But what do you know about Phil Collins? Arguably greater poet. We're going to ask you three questions about the guy who made a lot more money than you writing verses. If you get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their voicemail. Carl, who is poet Billy Collins playing for?
Billy is playing for Susan Morville of Ann Arbor, Michigan.
All right, Billy, you ready to go?
Okay, and what's the category?
The category is Phil Collins. You know who Phil Collins is?
The Genesis guy.
Yeah, the Genesis guy,
okay,
and solo career of some repute. Here's your first question. Phil Collins made a name for himself as a show business legend long before he rose to the top of the pop charts, as when he appeared in which of these? A, British ads for Ivory Snow detergent playing the happy bare-bottomed baby on the box. B, the movie Chitty Chitty Bang Bang playing an angry child who storms the castle at the end. Or C, the Pink Floyd album cover Animals appearing as or inside the inflatable pig.
Wow. I'm going to have to say the B, or number two.
That would be the movie Chitty Chitty Bang Bang?
Yes.
You're right.
Oh, wow.
Phil Collins was a child actor, and he says he was cast in the movie and was in the scene when they stormed the castle at the end, but he says he was cut out because he had a bandage on his hand that the director didn't want in the film.
All right. I didn't know that much about it.
I have learned so much about Chitty Chitty Bang Bang on this show over the years.
Well, we basically keep returning to it. There's an endless font of information about that movie.
Very good.
Phil Collins, not just a musician, he's a Renaissance man. In addition to his musical talents, he is also what? A published expert on the Battle of the Alamo. B, a champion competitor in male rhythmic gymnastics. Or C, the world's foremost collector of Phil Collins memorabilia.
Let's see. I think it's B. I think it's gymnastics.
You think he's the competitor in male rhythmic gymnastics? I would love to see that, but yeah, believe it or like, not, the answer is A.
Oh, it is.
Yes, he. Wow. He Collins has collected Alamo memorabilia for years, and he is the author of The Alamo and Beyond, A Collector's Journey.
Wow.
Okay, here's your last question. Phil Collins' song, Against All Odds, the title song for the movie of that name, was nominated for an Oscar, but he did not get to perform the song at the Oscar telecast. Why not? A, he insisted on not starting the song, despite it being a live broadcast, until he, quote, felt the moment. B, in rehearsals, every time he sang the lyric, "Take a look at me now," he would look at the camera and wiggle his eyebrows. Or C, the show's producers had no idea who he was and refused his offer to perform.
I'm going to go with A.
You're going to go with A? He insisted he wouldn't start the song until he felt the moment?
Felt the moment.
Because that's the sort of thing that Phil Collins would do?
I'm right.
No, it was in fact C. The producers didn't know who Phil Collins was. The producers sent a note to his agent saying, "Thank you for your note regarding Phil Cooper." And they ended up having some other person sing it. Carl, how did poet Billy Collins do on our show?
He needed at least two correct answers to win. For Susan Morville, he had just one correct answer.
I'm sorry, Susan.
Aww. Perhaps you can compose an ode to a lonely
loser,
answer.
A losing poet.
Yeah, exactly. Billy Collins is the former poet laureate of both the United States and the state of New York. His latest book of poems, a collection called Aimless Love, is out now. Billy Collins, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank
Great.
You so much.
Thank you, Billy.
Thank you, Billy. That's it for our Best Of show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed not doing anything this week.